Welcome to this special edition of the IRIS podcast, taken from the 2010 IRIS Forum. This edition features a taster session showcasing the work of IRIS's three core programmes.
Okay, we're now going to switch to the home team, and what we're going to have is three taster sessions. Our work, as most of you probably know, is divided into three programmes. So each programme is going to just give you an example, showcase one or two pieces of their work. You'll hear, have much more of an opportunity in the afternoon workshops to spend time with one of these teams or indeed with Projectability. And I would just say not everybody has signed up for a workshop. Two of them are already full, so if you don't want to be herded into one of the or other of the two remaining, make sure you sign up just before lunch. We're going to run the three sessions one after the other, hopefully seamlessly moving from one to the other, and we're going to kick off with Ian Watson and Gillian Miller, who is the outside guest. We've tried to bring in an outside guest for each of the tasters. They are from Knowledge Media.
Yes, good morning everyone. As Alison said, my name is Ian Watson. I'm in charge of our Knowledge Media programme. What we want to illustrate in this taster session is the appropriate use of different types of media to get across learning messages and also to share knowledge. This project we worked with Stonewall Scotland on, and I'm going to hand you over now to Gillian Miller of Stonewall Scotland, who'll introduce the object, and then I'll show you a little bit about what we did with it.
Okay, thank you, Ian. First of all, I'll start with a little bit of background about Stonewall Scotland. We were originally established as a campaigning and lobbying organisation for lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender equality. But as legislative battles have been won over the years, we've shifted our focus slightly, and now we work with over 600 public and private sector organisations to help them to improve policies and practices for lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender staff and service users. We had a recent campaign and it was called Some People Are Gay, Get Over It, and we had 600 billboards across the UK, and I don't know if you can see quite right quite here is someone had graffitied kill them on it. I chose this image because I thought it quite eloquently put why we wanted to increase our impact and our reach by developing an online learning resource. So I run a programme of work called the Good Practice Programme. And we wanted to develop an online learning resource to promote the Good Practice Programme and to develop public service workforces' awareness and understanding of LGBT issues. The aim of the programme is to mainstream public LGBT issues into public services, really to helping organisations to critically examine the way their services are developed and delivered. We know that many organisations have the right policies in place, but often the practice doesn't marry up with what's written on paper. So the online learning resource was going to be a way to help us, to help other organisations to get the policies to the pavement. We work with various public services across a wide range. We see education, local authorities, criminal justice partners, so a very wide range of public services, and one of the biggest challenges for them is trying to understand why LGBT issues are relevant to their work. Another part of the online learning resource needed to do was to show our good practice, help develop learning and guidance for staff within the public services, and also to showcase research which we produced to develop the evidence base. So from that, I really wanted to do the case studies which were based on people's real experiences. I think very often, particularly with equalities issues, it can become a bit of political correctness gone too far, and the real people who have negative experiences are lost in that. So we're looking at day-to-day experiences and really trying to get the layered effect of discrimination and how low-level homophobia day-to-day can impact the way that that people use and access services. And I also wanted to acknowledge the impact of fear. We know that there is an element of fear before accessing services around coming out, and the video that Ian will show will speak to that. I also wanted to help organisations to understand the service user journey, but not just from the moment the person puts their hand on the door to go into the service. I really wanted to take account of all of the things that happen in an LGBT person's life which affect the way that they use services. I really wanted the online learning resource to be active, interactive, and so that the learners were active in the way that they took forward their learning. So there are quizzes in there, and they're also sort of a way to record thoughts as the case studies go through. It's also very important that the learning is able to be translated into the way that the people carry out their work. So the learning has to be able to be taken away, not just used at the terminal. Also very, very important that it's easy to share. So for example, the Scottish Government have agreed to have the link to the resource put onto their equality impact assessment tools, really help so that when staff go through the EQIAs, they can learn more about the issues before they tick the no, it doesn't have an impact on LGBT people. So why did we choose IRIS? Well, I was aware of previous work that IRIS had done in terms of their online learning tools, their MESOP one and the LEAP framework in particular, I had been very impressed with and actually used before I knew that it was IRIS that had produced them. I knew what outcome I wanted to achieve, but I didn't really know how to get there. And so IRIS were able to work very collaboratively with me to ask all the right questions to ensure that the outcomes were met. They also were able to produce something which was able to be used within my existing systems, technical systems, so that it wasn't too onerous to upkeep. And they also had experience of overcoming the technical challenges that often, the barriers to using IT in public services. And this was really something that IRIS could offer that no one else could. Also, in terms of invest to save and value for money, it was something around, the idea that actually in the long run it will save me money. And in the current funding climate where I'm not sure about additional funding to carry the work of the Good Practice Programme through, I know that there's a legacy there that can be easily accessed and easily used by public services without too much input from me. And also, it was built on a platform which could be turned into a kind of benchmarking tool, and sort of that's a kind of idea of making it a fee-paying type of resource. So there's kind of a lot of options with this resource. So I'll pass you on to Ian now, who will talk through the process and what they did. Thanks.
Thank you, Gillian. Yes, well, I hope we can go over the technical barriers, but we never know when they're going to rear their head. As Gillian said, we work collaboratively with Stonewall, and the key thing was to work through a number of scenarios that were plausible. They wouldn't contain stereotypes, because the audience for this are people who might not realise they're being homophobic. So if we cast homophobia as the baddies, they're going to say, well, that's not me. So we had to try and come up with scenarios that would get over how people in their day-to-day life might be unconsciously or low-level homophobic. Stonewall came up with the scenarios. We commissioned a script writer and came up with some scripts. There then follows a process of script editing. We had some guidelines that the number of words that translates into so many minutes of film, and what we realise is fewer words the better, so we have to pare back the amount of writing. We also have to make sure that all the learning points are coming over clearly. Having come up with a script, we then handed that over to a casting director who looked around for professional actors who would look good in these parts. She's also got a background in educational drama and was able to offer additional input to how the educational points would come over. We hired a professional film crew. And then we set about finding locations, which usually involves friends, family and all sorts. You've got a nice flat. Would anybody mind if we painted homophobic slogans on your wall? And amazing number of people who were quite open to this. Odd bottle of gin slipped to them, sort of seems to do the trick. But anyway, and we hired a director who, again, understood the process of filmmaking and what happens, how you make actors feel comfortable with a director. Now, that's enough on the rough background, but we're trying to illustrate there is a process behind this. There is a number of things we need to consider. And what we'll do now is move straight on and let you see what's not quite the finished article, but is close to it. First thing we have is a quiz in which the audience, this is aimed at people working in all parts of the public sector. You're invited to answer a question. I'm going to choose at random here because I can't actually read the question from where I'm standing. And these questions aren't necessarily right. Well, they are right and wrong answers, but the idea is whichever one you choose, you're then given a background as to the, you know, what's behind that question, what's the percentage of people who are LGBT, with references to further reading and further resources, further sources. I'm just going to go back. So the quiz allows the user to test their knowledge. And then we have a series of case studies. I'm going to go on to number three and play that, I hope. Apologies if there's a little dark one here. Again, find a location, Friends Flat, nice part of Thornwood, if you know it, in Glasgow. While this is playing, the viewers invited here to a little dialogue box.
Another letter. It says, "Die Bent Boy." No, I can't contact the police. They've got stabbings and murders to deal with. They've not got time for a gay guy that's getting a hard time from his neighbour. But he hasn't actually laid a finger on me. No, I'll wait and see. I don't want to be too hasty. No, listen, I don't want you to come over. I don't want you to get involved too. I haven't slept properly for weeks. Of course I'm anxious, but I can't talk to the doctor about this. And anyway, I don't want to go into sleeping tablets. No, I'm not contacting the police. I'll go to the housing department. I mean, I wouldn't have to tell them I'm gay, would I? Okay, I promise I'll tell you if anything else happens. I will. Okay, take care. Bye.
So down there, the viewers invited to record their thoughts. And the key things are there is the subject of the video is concerned. You get an example of what his concerns are. Does he have to talk about his sexuality when he goes to the housing department? So in the next scene we take you to is when he gets to the housing department and tries to...
Hello there, my name is Mrs. Marie Cuthbertson. Now it's Mark, isn't it? As you probably know, Mark, at North Inch Housing Association, we have an ongoing commitment to provide appropriate care and support to all our tenants on an individual basis. Now, the best way to do this is by referring every inquiry to the relevant department, so every tenant gets the right support. Now, my job today is just to make an initial assessment of your needs, and then we'll take it from there. So, what brought you here today?
I want to move out of the flat I'm in. I want to move to a different area.
I see. And so you started your tenancy at flat 1/159 Oakland Street, on November 15th, 2009. Now, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Well, you were very fortunate to get that place. The kitchen and the bathroom had just been upgraded before you moved in. Are the renovations proving problematic?
No.
So everything's working as it should? No structural problems? Or?
Look, the flat's perfect. The new kitchen's lovely, so is the bathroom. It's not that.
I see. So something else is causing you concern?
It's the close. I don't feel safe there.
Right. Has the secure door entry system been broken?
No, it's not that. It's the neighbours.
So you're not getting along with some of the tenants in your close?
No, I got on with everyone else fine, but it's just one neighbour.
Well, I'm sure you will appreciate that if we relocate every tenant who develops a dislike to one of their neighbours, nobody would stay in the same flat for longer than a few days. It would be chaos, wouldn't it?
But it's more than that. He stares at me when I'm passing him in the close and he says things under his breath.
And what does he say?
I'm not sure. I can't really make out what he's saying.
I see. Do you know this gentleman's name?
James Lavery.
James Lavery, resident of flat 3/359 Oakland Street.
Yeah, that's him.
Well, we do have a mediation team. Now, they would intervene and arrange for a meeting between you and Mr. Lavery to discuss your issues. Has there been an actual dispute between the two of you?
No, not as such. It's just get it in for me. I've had notes posted through my door.
And what do these notes say?
I'd rather not go into that.
Okay. Have you seen Mr. Lavery posting these notes?
No, but I know it's him.
Well, our community relations unit is responsible for investigating any alleged antisocial behaviour. But I'm afraid without some firm evidence, I can't ask them to intervene. Is there anything else you want to tell me about any incident between you and Mr. Lavery?
No, I've told you. He's made my life hell. I can't sleep at night. I'm really anxious.
Well, I think you should arrange to see your doctor. But at this stage, I don't think your complaint merits any further investigation.
So there's nothing you can do to help me?
Well, I can have one of our officers contact Mr. Lavery and remind him of his obligations to adhere to his tenancy agreement.
Why can't you move me to somewhere else? Or move him?
Well, I don't think there's sufficient evidence for an eviction order or indeed an antisocial behaviour order. Not at this stage. Do come back if there's any further incidents between you and Mr. Lavery. Or if you have any information you want to share with us.
Why can't you see what's going on?
So I hope that gives you a flavour of it. It develops, the situation does escalate, the housing department do have to step in and call the police, and at the end of it we have the housing officer reflects on the various points in which she felt she couldn't intervene, where she was trying to do her best to get to the bottom of his difficulty. The other thing I would say, Gillian mentioned extendability, usability. This one also works on a mobile phone, so if you're away and out and about with a reasonably good broadband connection, you can watch the videos and follow your way through the object. Thank you very much. I hope it gives a taster of one aspect of the Knowledge Media programme's work. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Ellen Daly. I'm part of IRIS's evidence-informed practice team. And along with my colleague Emma Collins and Gordon Dunbar from the Joint Improvement Team Action Group, I'm going to say a little bit about some work we're doing around supporting outcomes-focused practice and how this is actually being practically used. I'm going to go back one. We've heard a lot about outcomes already today. I must have heard it about 15 times. Caroline's brilliant presentation. This shift from a kind of what we call a service-led approach to an outcomes-focused approach. So really, what matters? What's the impact of those services on people's lives? So we're the evidence-informed practice team, so we have an evidence base to the work we do. And this is just really to highlight that there is evidence around the effectiveness of the outcomes approach. The University of York, the SPRU unit, have been doing research on outcomes since 1996. SPRU and SKY, which is the Social Care Institute for Excellence based in London, did a joint knowledge review in 2006, looking at the progress of developing outcomes-focused practice for older people. The Joint Improvement Team have done a lot of work around this. You might be familiar with talking points. And outcomes is now widely reflected in lots of policy agendas. This is just a couple, this is not a comprehensive list. Better health, better care, the personalization agenda, and self-directed support. It's not, outcomes is not just about social work, social services, social care. It's very much about health as well. So that's just to give you a sense of the background to this work. There's various different types of outcomes. These have been identified through research that JIT did. There's outcomes for people that use services. There's also outcomes for their unpaid carers. I'm just going to highlight a couple of outcomes and the different types for people who use services. Quality of life outcomes. These can involve feeling safe, having things to do, seeing people, staying as well as you can. These things impact the quality of life for people that use services. There are also process outcomes that have been identified. So what happens during the processes and the interactions with people that matter? Being listened to, having a say, having a voice, treated with respect, everything that you and I would expect. And there are also change outcomes, so improved confidence and morale, improved skills, improved mobility, etc. As I said, there's types of outcomes for carers as well, but this is just to give you a flavour of the kind of things we mean when we talk about outcomes. The importance of leadership has been highlighted. These are two sort of key quotes, one from Better Health, Better Care from Scottish Government, and one from the SWEA report. Leadership has been highlighted as vital for taking through this shift in culture and shift in practice to an outcomes-focused approach. It's central to improving performance. It has an impact on the outcomes. So I'm going to pass over to Emma, who is going to tell you a little bit about how we've taken leadership and outcomes and developed a project around these. Thank you.
Hi. So as Ellen said, there's a really good evidence base to show that working in an outcomes-focused way can have real benefits for people who use services and their carers. But obviously, this can seem like a really huge, daunting culture shift. So effective leadership is crucial for driving that forward. So what we've done is develop a guide called Leading for Outcomes. In developing this, we talked to a lot of people who really know their stuff in this area, including the JIT talking point teams and those who have been involved in the piloting of the talking points in the local authorities in Scotland. And it seemed from our conversations that there really was this gap for something to do with leadership and outcomes. We're very keen not to duplicate things that already exist, so it was important to us to make sure that what we were going to be developing would be of real benefit and fill this gap. So we developed this manual. It's a very, very practical resource. It's got a lot of training materials, exercises, scenarios, case studies, etc. But it's also meant to be really adaptable. We'd actively encourage team leaders who are going to be using the manual to use, for example, the audit tool at the front to identify the bits of training and so on that are really relevant to their team. We would suggest that people adapt scenarios or create their own scenarios to make it relevant to their own areas of practice, and to really focus on things that are you know, going to be useful to their team at that point, rather than maybe things they're already doing and are really good at, or things that they're maybe not quite ready to move on to yet. So I'd just like to tell you a little bit about what's in the manual. There are 7 sections. The first part is about kind of coming to a common understanding of what outcomes are, so everybody's on the same page and everybody agrees with where we're trying to get to and how that's actually different, and if it is different from what people are already doing. Then there's a bit about addressing the challenges of the approach. Now, for some people, it's a really big change, for others less so, but we felt it was really important to acknowledge those barriers and possibly fears and try to deal with them up front before just saying, and now do something differently. Then we look at how you can identify outcomes with people who use services and their carers in practice, and how those aspirations for outcomes can be put together into an actual plan for that person's care and support. We explore risk in an outcome setting, and then we also look at how to measure progress in an outcomes-focused approach, both for the individual who is being supported, but also as a team, how we're changing from the method of support we were using towards an outcomes-focused approach, and how that can be sustained and embedded going forwards. It's not just a bolt-on to what you're already doing. It's not, we're now doing outcomes. It's making that change a sort of consistent feature of work. And then finally, there's a section specifically about leadership, which is about looking at what support you as a leader might need, whether you need further training, whether your organisation can support you in various ways, and also to reflect on how the training has gone for you and your team and what you can continue to do. Once we had developed the manual, we took it to a variety of practitioners to pilot it. And this is really exemplifies the way that we try to work as a team, where we do things with a small number of people before rolling it out nationally. So we piloted the manual by doing 2 full training days with practitioners from Fife, from Glasgow, and from South Lanarkshire. And they gave us a lot of really great feedback, and we're currently incorporating that into the manual. It wasn't an exercise for us in any way. We've taken all of that and made significant changes to what we had originally put together based on what people told us would work for their teams in practice. That's going to be available on our website from the end of November, and we'd really encourage you to take a look at it. We're still looking for feedback. We're positioning this as a beta version, and we'll be actively looking for feedback up until March, when we'll be releasing the final version of the Leading for Outcomes manual. We're now calling this the Parents Manual, and we have 3 topic-specific companion manuals also in development. They're being developed with the evidence-informed practice team alongside experts and practitioners in each of the areas. So the 3 areas that we have are parental substance misuse. We're working with a wide variety of people in that. There's a really good team in place. We're going to be working with Aberlour's residential parental substance misuse units alongside people from ADSW, from the Scottish Government, and from the academic sector. We're also going to identify a 3rd topic, which will be between joint working between health and social care, but we're yet to focus in on a specific area for that. And we'll be looking at outcomes in dementia. And for that, we're going to be working with Gordon Dunbar from the Joint Improvement Team, and he is going to come up and tell you a little bit about that work we're doing just now. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Emma. We were posed some questions earlier by Caroline, who was asking how many of us had a will, and a significant number of hands went up. How many of us have identified the care home that we want to go to? I thought somebody's hand was actually moving there, but it didn't quite go up. Does anybody have a kind of picture of a particular care home that you think, yes, that's the one for me? That's the one that I want to be able to move towards. Somebody's able to do that. Thank you. The Joint Improvement Team are working collaboratively with IRIS, the Care Commission, Scottish Borders Council and Scottish Care. In terms of taking forward a challenge put by the Scottish Minister at the Scottish Care Conference last year, which was very much about how do we take an outcomes approach and embed it into a care home in setting. Talking Points was very much designed as a community resource. It was very much designed around how we produce assessments, very much putting people at the heart and starting with what matters to them rather than a kind of one size fits all that we've had some conversations about. We've developed a pilot which we're about 4 months into that pilot now, and we'll run through to mid-summer. But the pilot is very much about how do we begin to change the focus within a care home environment from the tasks that seem to dominate towards what matters to individuals? How do we begin to make that change? And I think what we know from the community setting is that leadership and frontline management very much lie at the heart of driving this change in culture forward. And we've been working with IRIS in terms of how do we create that real enthusiasm to move from task-orientated work. What time does somebody get up? What time do they have their breakfast? What time do they change their path? What time do we do all of these tasks? And actually start with what matters. And I'll tell you just a bit of a story as I keep my eye on this clock here, if I've got time in just a second, in terms of one of the experiences we've had. But I think what's been really helpful for us is reflecting with IRIS in terms of how do we begin to embed this change in culture from staff who've got their SVQ 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. How do we begin to change their thinking in terms of starting with what matters to the individual? I want to just tell you a very brief story. We're working with three care homes, two from the private sector, one local authority. Each of the care homes are scoring fairly highly, very highly in terms of the Care Commission. They've got excellent leadership within each of the care homes. And one particular care home told us about how they had formed their evening activities. They had a really great sense of evening activities planned, different people coming in on different nights. They had their catering staff staying later so that supper could be prepared and ready. Residents could come, enjoy supper with others if they wanted. They could take it to their rooms if that's what they wanted, or they could have somebody take it to the rooms. So a whole variety of options. And from an inspectorial point of view, I reckon there's nothing you could do to kind of flaw that. When we had some conversations with staff about talking points and moving our thinking away from what matters to the organisation and the care home to what matters to the individual, this particular care home thought, right, Tom's the man. We'll have a conversation with Tom about, you know, what are the things that we do really well and what really matters to him. So in that first conversation with Tom, what became clear really quickly was that he really didn't enjoy evenings. And the manager was a bit taken aback by that because they thought they had really pretty much got their evenings sorted. And what Tom was saying was, I absolutely hate sandwiches and I hate cakes. You know, I haven't had a bit of Ryvita on patty since I left my house. And he said, well, what I really miss is being able to get up, go and get the Ryvita out the tin, get a bit of patty and do something, you know, that suits me. So what they did was they were initially going to order in patty, but actually he could quite easily go out and get his own. So off he went, he brought his own patty in with his Ryvita. He could get up at 3 o'clock in the morning if that's what he wanted to do. And what they found was, this is a long story, and I'll kind of cut to the quick on it, was that a number of other people started to say, hey Tom, what's that you're having for your supper tonight? I could do with a wee bit of patty as well, because I haven't had some of that for ages. But the other really interesting thing was when he was out at the shop buying his patty, he got into a conversation with somebody else, and the conversation led to their mutual interest in bowling, and a conversation then led on to, why don't you come down to the bowling club? So all of a sudden, he was now able to prepare his own meal. He would get up and he would do that for himself rather than have one of his little carers come in and doing it for him. He was able to prepare his own supper. He was motivated in terms of getting out there. He then had a social interest, and as a consequence of that, the whole quality of his life has significantly improved. But actually the real challenge, I think, is around how do we help staff engender that kind of approach to all residents so that we start our care planning with what matters to the individual, not with what matters to the tasks that we need to do. And the work that the Scottish Borders pilot is doing alongside IRIS is just incredibly useful in beginning to tease out some of the real issues and the real challenges about how do we embed an outcomes approach into that care home situation. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Great, thank you. So, hi, my name's Lucy Robinson, and I'm the Project Manager for Innovation and Improvement at IRIS. I just firstly wanted to start with kind of how we talk about innovation at IRIS, and it really chimed with what Caroline was talking about earlier, because what it felt like her story was that everything that existed, she was challenging and saying, actually, do we have to do it like that? Isn't there another way? And for us at IRIS, it's really about that. It's about saying, actually, is the status quo the right way of doing it? Or is there other ways of doing it? You know, constantly kind of challenging. So that's kind of where we're starting from. And just to say, there's a booklet in your folder today, which talks a bit more about the Innovation and Improvement Programme. But what are program is about, the Innovation and Improvement Programme, is about supporting and enabling innovation and improvement in social services in Scotland. And what we're doing at the moment is we're focusing more on organisations and about individuals and social workers working within those organisations so that they actually can kind of innovate, giving them the skills and the support that they need. And we're doing that in kind of two ways. At the moment, we're doing demonstration projects. So we've got three projects that we're running at the moment. And Adam Ingram kind of stole my thunder a bit because he kind of talked about those projects. But we've got one which is called Creating a Culture of Innovation, where we're working with a local authority department to actually kind of develop a training program about innovation. So giving those social workers the skills and the ideas and the information that they need so they can actually start doing things differently. Also doing a program with a mental health charity looking at redesigning their services. So as they're trying to implement self-directed support, to see if we can help them to actually kind of tailor that so that they're actually developing a service which is focused around the users of those services. And then the final demonstration project that we're doing on at the moment, my colleague Ricky is going to talk about in a moment. Now, the purpose of all these demonstration projects is to kind of showcase that we can do things differently. It's not about kind of going and doing it across the whole of Scotland. It's about kind of working with particular organisations, particular local authorities, and trying out new ways of working so that hopefully we can kind of find new solutions that can then be kind of scaled up or rolled out. So the other kind of part of the work that we do, where do I click? Great. It's kind of more kind of research type work, doing reports. So we did some research earlier this year looking at actually kind of capabilities, barriers to innovation and improvement in social services in Scotland. And that's formed kind of the basis for a lot of our work. So all the support and enabling work that we're doing is kind of founded on actually what are the challenges that people are really facing. So we're doing, kind of research, doing kind of bringing people together. You'll see some kind of work around the champions that the Evidence Informed Practice Programme and the Innovation Improvement Programme is doing, and actually I think a few of our champions are here today. And we're also doing a series of events, so things like Adam Ingram talked about how we're kind of looking at risk and kind of challenging kind of what risk means and making it into something quite positive. So that's kind of a little bit of an introduction to our programme, and I'm now going to hand over to my colleague Ricky, who's going to tell you about a really exciting project that we're working on at the moment. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
I'm Ricky Iversholt, and I love data. I always get the fear when I have to talk about it because I know it's so dry. And when I got up this morning, I listened to Farming Today, and I was so delighted because there was all these farmers talking about how they were collecting data on migrating birds and how there was this farmer saying, we're realising that data is only as good as the people that gather it. But we've increased, you know, the numbers 15 or 50% over the last year, so we're doing really well. And I thought if these farmers can make data and the gathering of it sound really interesting, I think in social work we'll be absolutely fine. So let's jump straight in. This is our starting point. This all these numbers on this slide are actually the data behind the ESE survey, which is gathered by local authorities every year. And the project that I've been working on in the last year has been a pilot project with the Scottish Consortium for Learning Disability. They tally up all this data and do some things with it, but we have been working with them to take it further. And the little journey I'm going to take you on has taken it from this really terrifying, boring speck of numbers through this, and I'm saying through because this is very important. This is probably where a lot of visualization that you're used to, this is where it stops. This is what you're used to seeing, and you know, your eyes glaze over and the report gets really long and boring. To what we've been doing, actually making it a lot more engaging, making more sense of it, more accessible, and putting it into a context that draws you in, essentially. Now, just briefly, the background for the SCLD pilot is that it was a nice, dense data set. It's quite small. When I'm saying small, the first year was 26,000 records. It's gone up to just about 30,000 this year. It's small because you can actually eyeball trends. You can just filter through it, and it's quite easy. If you like that sort of stuff, it's easy to eyeball. So we wanted to investigate how we can support people better in making decisions from data by visualizing it, and we also wanted to help people make their audience make sense of it. So in the context of SCLD, it was really important that their users could use it as well. And for ourselves, we really wanted to investigate whether this was something we could do. We're really for open source. So we wanted to use tools that are available online that are, you know, other people are developing. They're constantly updated stuff that's free. And you guys can go in and, you know, tailor to your own needs as well. So those were the things that we wanted to do. Now, we have a process, it's 7 steps, and I'll take you through them. So the first ones will be really dry, and then it'll be more fun. Okay, the first step is acquire. Now, we did invite SCLD to come and help me out today, but they have an event as well. So I'm going to let Raymond from SCLD tell you in this video why the ESE data is gathered in the first place. Fraser, will you play it, please?
Collecting detailed information about people with a learning disability was a recommendation of the same as you, Review of Services, which made the recommendation that more information should be held in people with learning disabilities so they can improve the service provision and also inform future planning.
So that's the rationale behind why the data actually exists. In this first step, the acquire phase, it's really important to also sort of think about what you're going to do with this. So what are we dealing with? Who is it for? What are they going to use it for? All the things that are going to inform the further steps. And this is the audience. They don't look very engaged, but it's you know, why are we doing this for them? Why are we... And how can we make them engaged so that they can actually go and shout about it and get the big hands up? Okay. The next step is in the parsing. This is when it gets very dry. This is where I like to get my hands in and rename all the numbers to names and proper words so that they actually can start making sense. So that means you relabel headings, as I've pointed out, and especially in this SCLD data, we have an awful lot of 99s. It just means not known. So little things like that, it makes the whole eyeballing a lot easier to do. And the next stage is the filtering stage. This is where we sort of scale down the data. So we're actually only dealing with the things that we want to use, the things that we're interested in, and the data that will actually help us tell a proper story. The story is very important, otherwise we lose the audience straight away. So this is a screenshot of exactly the same data as I showed you before, but this is when it's been put into SPSS. And then it gets really fun. This is when you get to do mining. So this is where you start teasing out the stories properly, you know, investigating correlations to actually see, you know, a lot of the time you have, you assume that there's a, you know what stories you want to tell, and actually when you get down to the data isn't really there, but you might find something else. Quite often you find big gaps, and the gaps become really, really interesting. So another dry slide of a cross-tabulation. And this is when it starts getting fun. Once you know what you're wanting to say, you get to the representation stage and you start playing with basic representations. As I said earlier, this is where it normally ends. You'll be very familiar with a sort of standard table and a bar chart. But this is where we went a little bit further. The challenge here is to take the visualization and sort of improve upon it. Incorporate some context so that you're moving away from just raw numbers setting local authorities against each other, and it's not telling a story. Putting it into context, and, well, you know, you'll actually see this here is exactly the same as the visualization we've done. The bars we've put in the top right corner, and then the numbers are then adjusted to local authority and put in bubbles above each of the local areas. I find that a lot more engaging. I'll give you some more examples. I've actually sort of kept it to pretty much just the numbers that we have around employment of adults with learning difficulties in Scotland in the 2008 data, because that was our pilot period. So this is a bubble comparison chart. So each circle represents the local authority, and the size of the circle is adjusted to the local population. So you get straight away an indication of how big the population of people with learning difficulties in each area is. In addition to that, you'll then see that the different colors indicate something within these, and then proportionately they show how many people are in employment, not in employment, and not known. So in employment is dark blue and not in employment is yellow. This is the same data again. It's really pretty, isn't it? But it's these are nested bubble charts. It means it's nested when they sort of are squished together at the bottom or top. This is really interesting in that it's just exactly the same data, but you'll see from reading from the outside in, actually in the middle, I'll just walk over. This bit here is grayed out, but it doesn't show so well on the slide. Reading from the outside in the white sections, those are the raw numbers, and then in the gray zone in the middle, they're adjusted to local population. So you'll see once it's actually adjusted and you can compare the local authorities against each other, they don't vary as much, and it's a much easier to make decisions upon something like that. Although this is not something you take to a board meeting unless you really want to confuse them. But we wanted to really push the boat out and see what we could do. And I think Ian did well with this one. And this is the same data again as I showed you earlier. So this is it on a map. Now that we've actually taken all the time to draw this map, we're probably going to use that an awful lot more. So if you have data you'd like to put on a map, come to me. Okay. As I said, another thing we really wanted to do was try and find out how we could get the visualization of data to translate to users of services as well. And I took an awful lot of posters to one of the forums that they ran, and SCLD ran for me, actually. And the only one that really translated really well, but was very, very immediate, was the heat map. The one I showed them was online, which means that it's, you know, interactive. And I've done a screenshot here, so you'll see that in the black bar, it comes up with actually the numbers and the detail behind. I don't know if you're familiar with heat maps, but the intensity of color just means it's a higher number. And this was really, really engaging. Okay, The last stage is the communication stage, and this is Stuart from SCLD. He'll tell you what they've done with the data so far, how they've taken it further.
We attended an event in Scottish Borders as part of Learning Disability Week, where we presented the information and the posters from the visualisation project. It gathered quite a lot of interest. We got a lot of people coming over to speak to us, just having seen the posters and interested to find out more about these.
That's what they've done so far. What we're doing is working with local authorities in the next year. We're also going to continue our relationship with SCLD, and we're going to do an online tool, so I'm not the only one who gets to play with data. You could all do that if you wish. I know it's very, very confusing probably to throw all of this at you. So the images that I've shown you are on the memory sticks that are in your bags, and there are also postcards in your bags. There's plenty more at front if you wish to take some with you. And do contact me if you have data that you wish to get prettified or made more sense of.
Thanks very much indeed, Ricky, and hopefully... hopefully that's given you just a sense of some of the work within each of our three programmes.